Well, welcome to this lecture for MCF for week 7 of term 2 on rural change in France. Now, I've provided the lecture handout, which contains a few details, background details as ever, for the lecture, and also the PowerPoint. On the for the lecture today, I'm going to go through sort of the history of the paysan, history of rural people in France. And then I'm going to look at the idea of rural change and this concept of modernisation in France, which has come into effect really since the more or less the Third Republic onwards. And we'll look at how ideas such as and concepts such as the Marshall Plan and the European Cornerstone Community helped to really push France towards an industrial urban centre, rather than having a sort of strong rural base. And in the third part of the lecture, I'm going to look at this idea of the paysan striking back. So through Pierre Puget and the Pugetiste movement, but then also more recently with José Bové, another example of somebody really raising the profile of rural France and combating for the rights of people like farmers living in the countryside in France. So that's what I'm going to be talking about in the lecture. I think, first of all, it's worth starting with this idea of le paysan. You know, who is le paysan? Well, le paysan can be quite varied, really. It doesn't necessarily mean a farmer. It can actually mean anybody, really, who's living in the countryside, who works in the countryside, and it includes such a huge range of different people, different interest groups, such as petits commerçants, you know, little shopkeepers, artisans, and mainly agricultural workers, people who ply their trade within the countryside rather than in sort of the urban centres of France. And on the opening slide of the handout, I've actually included there a picture of Time magazine's front cover from 1956. And here we have Pierre Puget, a man who himself would have called himself a paysan, was not actually from a farming stock, but he was somebody who owned a small bookshop in a small town in the Lot department in southern France. And he was somebody who really stood up for paysan in the 1950s and challenged this idea of centralisation, challenged the notion of urbanisation, and really wanted to represent the interests of people who would call themselves paysan. Now, paysan is not by any means a term of a sort of negative, derogative term in France. It's actually seen as a term for many people. It's seen as a term of endearment, and it's seen as almost a badge of honour, simply because to be a paysan, you are associated with a very strong identity. A very strong rural identity, but also a strong regional identity. So an identity with certain areas of France, such as the sort of largely rural western département in particular, also the southwest, and then the area around the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur around there, and in the Languedoc. These are very strong rural areas. In eastern France, below Alsace-Lorraine, you have also an area of small area of rural France, and then of course in the centre. So each particular area, each region has a very strong identity. But I'd say that the real heartbed of, you know, the real sort of rock of paysan identity can be found in places like the Vendée on the Atlantic coast, and then equally somewhere like the Lot, the Dordogne, places where many British people have actually gone on holiday and have bought houses in recent years. So the paysan are not by any means, you know, intended to be a derogative term. Rather, I'd say it's something which many people take some pleasure in being called. And the term itself derives from this notion of le pays. So le pays is both a nation state, so in the sort of conventional sense of the term. Translation into English would of course be country. So it's the nation state, but it's also a region within a country. So there's a concept of the Le pays légal, so the sort of a nation state, the institutions and the laws of a nation state. And then there's the pays réel, coined by Charles Maurras, who we saw a little bit in week 2's lecture on Vichy. But he was really a man who provided a lot of the ideas and motivations for Vichy's national revolution. So Maurras came up with this idea of the pays réel being more important than the pays légal, in the sense that it was very much a thing of genuine reality, and it wasn't constructed around these sort of artificial notions of liberté, égalité and fraternité, but it was based on a real concept, a concept of the earth, of solid constructs. So to go back to this idea of le paysan, there are several different definitions of le pays, and really a paysan would identify with this regional notion, le pays réel, as opposed perhaps to the pays légal. In the Third Republic, other Catholic conservatives like Maurice Barrès, who was a very similar political persuasion to Charles Maurras, he found himself on the side of the anti-Dreyfusards during the Dreyfus Affair, and he talks of this idea of a cult of the earth. And of course it's kind of this notion of the earth being very, very important came back under Vichy. We saw that propaganda poster in week 2, la terre, elle ne ment pas, the concept that the earth doesn't lie, unlike urban politicians, urban demagogues. And this whole notion of the different versions of le pays really essential to understanding rural France and how it's changed in recent years. So the paysans have always played a very important role in French society, and they were actually the backbone of the French army under Napoleon and the First Empire, and they were used before then, around sort of 1792, they were used as the shock troops of the revolution, particularly artisans who rose up to help to defend the newly founded First Republic against the invading Prussians at the Battle of Valmy in 1792. So the paysans are used as sort of shock troops there. They support the pays légal in that sense, but they also then support the sort of counter-revolutionary movements that would identify more with the pays réel. So we have a big uprising in the Vendée, in Brittany, just after 1790, and this movement really is again peopled by paysans, by these people who are living in the country, plying their trade in the country. And as I say, there's always been a history of conflicts around the notion of state centralisation, which goes back to the First Republic, and then of course it had its own incarnations under Napoleon, who changed the way France was divided up in terms of départements. And whenever Paris has really tried to assert its authority over the rest of France, it's often found some resistance from paysans living in the rest of the country. So the going into World War I under the Third Republic, the countryside population, the number of paysans was actually quite high. And it had, there was a huge resurgence in regionalist movements in the Third Republic. People like Charles Maurras, people like Maurice Barrès, even people like Mistral, of course the wind in the south of France, in the Marseille area, when it's really quite windy, people refer to Le Mistral. And Mistral was somebody who was a real Provençaliste. He was he believed a lot in the regional distinctions of Provence. So this regionalism is quite important in the Third Republic going into World War One. However, the number of people who die in World War One is considerable. I mean, France loses 1.3 million soldiers. A huge number of it's a working population, but of course a huge number of paysans also die. When we look back, when we look ahead to World War Two, a number of agricultural labourers in particular are prisoners of war of the Germans then. So the impact of World War One really is that France's population takes a long time to recover. It actually doesn't recover back to its pre-First World War levels until 1950. And on the slide I have here with entitled "Declining Rural Population," we see a picture there of a war memorial in Sevignac near Aveyron. One of many examples of memorials to the number of French men who died in World War One. And it's important to note, of course, that many of the World War One battles were fought in rural areas. You know, so places like the fields of the Nord-Pas-de-Calais, which of course were the main battlefields of the First World War. And the French army, as it was again in the Second World War, and as it had been in the revolutionary period under the First Republic, the French army was very much peopled by and staffed by peasants. So there's a real sort of shift in the level of the rural population because of World War One. It has a huge impact on the number of people who were able to work the land, who were living in the countryside, who are local shopkeepers, artisans, and there's a great difficulty which France is confronted with in trying to stabilise the rural population, in trying to increase the number of farmers again. And of course we saw in week two how Vichy tried to encourage people to return to the land, the so-called back to the land subsidies, which offer financial incentives for families hoping to go back to the family farm. Actually, very few people actually took these up. You know, only 1,561 families ever took up the offer. But the fact is that the offer was there, and Vichy was very concerned with restoring some of the regional pride, which was espoused by people like Morat and, of course, Barrès and Mistral. So Vichy tries to encourage labourers to return to the family farm. It doesn't really succeed. You know, despite its own glorification of the countryside, its own glorification of farming and of agriculture and of the peasant, who is very much seen to be something of a hero in under Vichy, and many ministers under Vichy, people like René Bellin, the Minister of Labour, forget that it's actually the peasants who were an artisan who fought for the First Republic against the Prussians at Valmy. They were the shock troops of the revolution. But the ministers at Vichy tend to overlook this because of their romantic notions of the countryside in France, and romantic notions of the peasant. This cult of the peasant, the cult of the earth, is still very, very strong under Vichy. And actually, this is really, as I say, this is a long tradition of ruralism in France, which goes back to the Third Republic and beyond. And under the Third Republic, people like Émile Zola were writing novels dedicated to the peasant, dedicated to the traditions of rural France, and one of Zola's novels even entitled La Terre. And before that, Balzac, Honoré de Balzac, writes a novel entitled simply Les Paysans. So French literature tends to trumpet this idea of the peasant, and is very much glorifying the rural population, glorifying agricultural workers in a way which is quite often quite astounding, and really, really makes people living in urban centres in France, especially under the Third Republic, at a time when France was becoming slightly more industrialised. The Industrial Revolution had caught on, and Paris, for example, expands hugely. At this time, people living in Paris, for example, began to look more and more towards the countryside, and this really reaches its kind of apogee under Vichy, with the back to the land subsidies. So despite Vichy's attempts to try and repopulate the countryside through the back to the land subsidies and through a series of propaganda films and posters, you know, I mentioned a couple of these in the week two lectures, but one of the brilliant examples of a Vichy propaganda film trumpeting the importance of the paysan is a film called Nourrir la France, comes out in 1941, and which really is aimed towards feeding the French, but encouraging people to go to the family farm in order to feed their neighbours, their friends, their families. So it's a real it's effectively back to the Lambert in a film format. And in it we see, for example, a soldier return to the family farm, having been demobbed, having left the French army, and he's immediately ploughing the land, he's immediately helping his family to have food. And this is a really, I think, a really strong embodiment of Vichy's idealism of the Pizan. You know, this man, one minute he's fighting in the French army, and the next minute he's returning and in full military uniform, he's ploughing the land and providing for his family. So despite these efforts to really repopulate the countryside, Vichy fails. And coming out of World War II, there's a real sense of modernisation and industrialisation, which takes hold more than it ever has done in French history. You know, in World War II, France is still a relatively rural country. There's still quite a strong, although admittedly depleted after World War I, there's still a relatively strong rural population. There's still quite a lot of farmers and of commerçants, artisans living in the countryside. Although their numbers have decreased significantly since World War I, their traditions are still strong. And hence why Vichy really wishes to sort of try and enhance these traditions to get more people to return. But after World War II, the pace of industrialisation and modernisation picks up unlike any previous opportunity. So to move on to the sort of second section of the lecture then, which is this idea of rural change and the modernisation thesis. The impact of World War II is significant on modernising France. And after the collapse of Vichy, after the liberation of France, France is, of course, as we saw in week three, desperate to get back on its feet. And financial aid brought in by the Marshall Plan, by the Bloom Prestatut, the Bloom-Burns Agreement, and then, of course, the European Coal and Steel Community. All of these plans aim to modernise France, to increase industry and to drive up productivity. So there's, of course, this is really helped by a real increase in the French level of French population after World War II. Now, I think this is a combination of two things. Firstly, it's Vichy's natalist policies. So, you know, things like the priority access to public services for mothers of large families, promotion in the workplace for fathers of large families, the opportunity to receive financial rewards from the state should you actually, you know, should you father, should you give birth to a large number of children. These initiatives really do actually take hold, despite the fact that people are increasingly sceptical and indeed hostile to Vichy as the war goes on, the birth rate continues to rise. Then this is undoubtedly in part due to these financial incentives and due to the whole series of propaganda films, like Le Gel en Son Fleur, 1942 film, which aimed to drive up the birth rate. But I think also it's due to the fact that there's very little else to do in France during World War II. You know, the cinema is of course very popular, but other forms of activity are either very expensive or in some cases they're banned. So for instance, dancing is actually banned in the occupied zone. So you have these whole series, and Robert Gilday has described as whole series of clandestine dances in the occupied zone. People who had to meet under the cover of dance and dance the night away. But for those people who couldn't enjoy dancing, producing a large family was actually obviously something of a wish. So the French population increases quite significantly from 40.5 million at the end of World War II in 1945 to 52.6 million in 1975. So in the three decades that followed, what we call the 30 glorieuses, 30 glorious years, the population increases massively. And of course, with this increase in population, population we know really, we sort of term in this country as the baby boomers, the number of the working population also substantially increases. So not only have you got a bigger overall population, but also the number of people able to work, able to drive up productivity also increases. So the Trente Glorieuses sees a huge increase in modernisation and indeed in industrialisation, following, of course, the implementation of the Marshall Plan and the financial aid, which allows France, I mean, France largely the intervention of Jean Monnet, allows France to put itself back on its feet, to go about rebuilding itself, to go about investing in industry, machinery. And this has a big impact on the farm, you know, local family farms in the rural parts of France, and also in terms of people living in France and in rural France and their livelihoods. Not just the farmers, but people like petit commerçants, artisans, who really rely on a strong rural population to get their, you know, to get their services, to get a profit out of their business. And obviously after World War One, the rural populations hit quite badly. And then the fact that it never really increases thereafter means that these people were already living on very slim profit margins going into World War Two. After World War Two, that their income declines hugely, largely because people are moving as never before. They're moving into industrial centres. The real industrialisation of France, prompted by martial aid, actually throws many people to go to work in cities and in large towns, as opposed to in small villages or commune. And we see a huge number of people moving away from the countryside. So these petit commerçants, these artisans, their customer base is declining ever more. So although we see naturally with any form of increased productivity and increased profitability for French companies, we see an increase in social improvement in social conditions, but it also means that the number of family farms begins to decline hugely. So, you know, despite Vichy's complaints in 1940 that the number of family farms was small, it was nonetheless more than 2 million. And from 2 million in 1950, the number of family farms in France decreases to 1 million in 1990. So in 40 years, which is obviously comparatively not a particularly long period, in 40 years the number of family farms in France halves. So a significant decrease over that period. So the emphasis on industry ahead of agriculture, and an emphasis on towns and cities ahead of villages and commune, means that the population, the rural population in France, the number of paysans, are decreasing hugely. Now, farmers, of course, become reliant on chemical fertilisers and on sort of hybrid products to increase their own profitability. We also then see this idea of people training themselves in agriculture rather than learning on the job. So they go into specialist colleges, lycée agriculturel, to try and learn the trade as opposed to learning on the job. So it's a kind of professionalisation of the farming business, if you will. And then we also have sociologists who come in and review the state of French family farms, like someone like Henri Mondrat, who suggests that chemical and technological advances mean the end of the family farm. And I just want to return to a previous point, which is just to say that, you know, this, for the average person in the countryside, naturally things are, you know, their life is improving. You know, the average life expectancy is rising hugely. So from 62, average life expectancy is increasing from the age of 62 to 69 for men and 67 to 77 for women. Huge increase, of course. Yet their trade and their livelihoods have been challenged as never before. And I've got on a slide here, we've got a few examples of some of the changes that happen in French agriculture. So we've got, you know, from going from a sickle, going from horse-drawn ploughs, which are very, very common in France before industrialisation, before mechanisation, to having a combine harvester. And of course, as ever with industry, if you mechanise a process enough, it decreases the number of labourers needed. So of course, the number of people working on the farm, the number of people needs to work on a family farm, goes down hugely anyway. This coincides, of course, with the natural exodus of some people leaving the farm to go and work in the city. I mean, France is by no means unique in this sense. You know, we certainly experienced it ourselves in Britain. Loads of people went for instance, South Wales, left South Wales to go and work in for instance, Cardiff and then London. So France is by no means unique, but the fact is the effects are felt more acutely in France because of its history as a rural nation. So we have on the slide here, this slide entitled Changing Methods, Increasing Productivity, some examples of the improvements enacted really through industrialization and through mechanization. So you look at in 1800 it took an hour with a sickle to harvest 100 square meters of corn, but whereas in 1945 a combine harvester would take 35 seconds to do the same job, and the threshing, which was previously carried out as a different job. So a huge decrease in the time taken to undertake tasks on a farm. Now obviously this proves productivity. It improves productivity, it also improves the efficiency of a farm. But the fact is that the people living in these rural areas has declined hugely. And then many people have gone off to cities, to towns, and while farms are able to produce food, to grow food and harvest crops more easily, the people living in these areas have decreased, and there's less of a sense of community than there was before World War I, for example. And there's no accompanying desire to go back to family farms, to reignite the ruralism of France in the time, as happened under the Third Republic. We don't have an equivalent of Charles Maurras or Maurice Barrès, none of these sort of right-wing conservative nostalgists. We don't have any of these figures in World War II, after World War II, in the post-war period. And so consequently, there's no one really to champion the cause of the Paysans, to champion French rural traditions, until Pierre Puget comes along. So Puget comes along in the sort of very early to mid-1950s. Now, Pierre Puget is a fascinating man. As I said, I included him on the opening slide, this cover of Time magazine. The fact that he actually made it to the front cover of Time magazine at the time says a lot about the man. He was able to transform what was essentially quite a local issue and make it a really national issue. And he championed the cause of paysans, he championed the cause of petit commerçant. He was really on the side of the small businessman as opposed to the big business. And Puget, some of Puget's real motivations were in preventing big business from taking hold and actually really looking after the lot of the ordinary commerçant. And Puget was by no means a huge political figure beforehand. He had having had a brief period as a section leader for the Compagnons de France, one of Vichy's youth movements. He actually left France for Spain, then joined the RAF as a volunteer pilot in Britain, and he actually then of course was on the side of the British and the Allies at the end of World War II. And so he'd had this experience of being a kind of résistant on the side of the Allies at the end of World War II. So he'd gone from supporting Vichy right the way through to a full-on role in the Allied war effort. So Puget had gone from these beginnings to really become something quite important in terms of a leader of a ruralist movement as never before in France. And Puget was somebody who, as I say, was a very effective orator, but he's also somebody who had humble beginnings, who was really quite keen on just looking after the interests of the small businessman. And one point I think is worth making is that the number of shops in France at the time in the 1950s was huge. The number of small shops was absolutely huge, staggeringly huge. So the ratio of shops to inhabitants in France in the mid-1950s was 62 per inhabitant of petit commerce. The ratio in Britain was 1 to 89, so per inhabitant, was per shop there were 89 inhabitants, and then in the USA it was 1 to 91. So obviously considerably lower ratios than the ratio, considerably higher ratios rather, than the ratio in France, which was much lower, 62 per inhabitant. So we have a huge number of little shops in France in these rural areas, and they really relied on a strong local customer base in order to turn a profit. So Puget really wants to try and turn this around. You know, he wants to try and look after the small businessman like himself. You know, Puget is not a farmer, he's not an agricultural labourer, he's not an artisan even, but he owns his own little bookshop in a place called Saint-Céré in the Lot department. And he is somebody who feels very strongly about trying to turn around the circumstances of Petit Commerçant, because of attempts to try and change the tax circumstances for Petit Commerçant. Now, despite their very slim profit margins, these Petit Commerçants try to not necessarily avoid tax, but certainly to underpay it. And the government clamps down on this in the 1950s and tries to reclaim the tax that it feels it's owed. So Puget really intervenes to try and stop this taxation. And Puget indeed and his followers try to prevent tax inspectors from arriving at small businesses which are suspected of tax avoidance or at least underpaying their tax. And this often results in quite violent scuffles in the streets, stopping tax collectors. And the government actually moves to make obstructing a tax collector an illegal offence. So it's punishable by either a fine or a spell in prison. So this is Puget's initial foray into activism. And he creates one union, and then this spawns several other unions to represent represent the interests of a number of different trades. So his initial union is the Union de Défense des Commerçants et Artisans, l'UDCA. This is really a union, this is a movement which, as I say, looks after the interests of petit commerçants and artisans. But then these are eventually joined by several other unions comprising different associations for farmers, students, travailleurs, so the sort of ordinary worker, and servicemen in the army. And from a quite humble beginnings, the Pujadist movement gathers quite a lot of pace. And in a rally in Paris in January 1955, the Pujadist movement actually attracts some 100,000 supporters, despite the fact that the Parisian authorities, the local authorities, refused to actually put on extra trains and buses to allow people to attend the rally. You know, the support is huge. So 100,000 people is quite a big, you know, big number in 1955. So from this, really, the Puget movement really sort of goes on a roll, and the UDCA decides to campaign in the January 1956 elections, really because Puget has been an activist since 1955, and a little bit before that. The movement's been able to get people to campaign on behalf of Petit Commerçant, and to really campaign for their interests. So, in a sense, the movement's already got a sort of basis for electoral campaigning. And in 1956, in the snap elections called by Edgar Faure, who was the Prime Minister at the time, after Mendès France, but before Mollet, Faure calls his election, and the UDCA, with Puget at the head, goes into full election mode, and it actually fields several different unions, several different sort of sub-parties, if you will, who actually field candidates sometimes in the same seat. So they, the fact that they are able to form unions with one another actually results in some of these candidates, when they win their seats in the National Assembly, being barred because of this illegal activity. But the main party is l'Union et Fraternité Française, which is Puget's main party. And they campaign under this slogan of sortez les sortants, you know, get rid of the current incumbents. Puget runs a campaign which is directed against any real politicians. You know, it doesn't have a particular target. It's anybody from Paris, and anybody who claims to be a politician, who claims not to have a profession. You know, they are very much targets of abuse. Not least The government, who of course had actually prevented this process of tax evasion on the part of some petit commerçants. So Pujade puts together a very quite a vitriolic campaign, really, aimed against people who he feels are the enemy of the paysan. And Pujade's real success is turning the anger and turning the fear of the mainstream parties against themselves. And he actually has there's a propaganda poster produced of Pujade with the slogan, "Beware, this man is dangerous." And of course, Pujade is pictured in a suit and tie looking every bit the respectable man. So he uses this sort of sense of, the fear of mainstream parties against them to try and turn people into supporting him. And Pujade tended to, one of the tactics employed by Pujade and Pujadiste was to disrupt the campaign meetings of other candidates, in particular mainstream candidates. And Pujade has a real hatred, hatred is the word, really, an intense dislike for Pierre Mendès-France. He absolutely despises the man. He is somebody who he believes to be a real enemy of the paysan, to be an enemy of France itself. And he breaks up Mendès-France's political meetings with his followers. He does the same to François Mitterrand, who at that time is hoping to try and become a candidate for Prime Minister of the Fourth Republic. And indeed, he breaks up meetings with Guy Mollet as well. So there's a whole series of different campaign meetings which are disrupted by the Pujadistes. But such is the success of the Pujadiste campaign that the UDCN, or the Union of Fraternité Française, actually receives some 11.6% of the vote. So it actually has over 2 million, so 2.5 million votes in the legislative elections of January 1956, and wins 52 seats, so a huge number of seats. And admittedly, while some of these are consequently disbarred because of this this irregularity with fielding the same party against each other, nonetheless, it's a huge number, and it's a real shock in France at the time. It really creates a stir in the French political system. And Paris Match actually runs that week with a picture of all 52 newly elected députés, some of whom are, they're bicycle repairmen, they are artisans, they are small commerçants, they're certainly not professional politicians. And of course, in something of eventual irony, one of Pujade's députés who's elected to the National Assembly is none other than Jean-Marie Le Pen, who at the time was a law student in Paris. So Le Pen even himself is elected under this Union et Fraternité Française banner. Now, so I think it's worth saying that the majority of the UDCR's electorate were shopkeepers, farmers, wine growers, and they were all from the sort of rural central and southwestern département, places like the Lot, where Pujade himself was from. These aren't people from Paris, they aren't from industrial centres. They're very much people who feel that Pujade is looking after their interests are the people who vote for the man himself. They're not, as I say, they're not cadres, they're not executives, they're not upper management. They're not necessarily people working in the middle classes and the upper classes in places like Paris. But they are these sort of petit commerçants living in rural areas. They are paysans who vote for the UDCR. So Pujade then takes the political world by storm through this shock success in the 1956 elections. But Pujade has something of a fatal flaw in the sense that he has a tendency to be both anti-Semitic and pro-Algerie Française. Pujade's quite sympathetic towards the Algerie Française movement. He's very much in favour of Pierre Noir, and his very first meeting is held in Algiers. So he's somebody who opposes the moves to give Algeria independence. So this combination of anti-Semitism and indeed, quite colonial sentiment, really, means that he sort of loses some support amongst ordinary voters. Not necessarily amongst his core constituents, but certainly in France as a whole, he's seen to be quite extreme. And the other parties other political figures give him the nickname Pujalolf because of his perceived fascism. Now, I don't think for 1 minute that Pujol was a fascist. I think it'd be very unfair to say so. He was certainly something of a conservative. He was also undeniably anti-Semitic and was obviously a sort of nostalgic ruralist. But I think fascist would be something of a misnomer, really, for Puget. He wasn't somebody who believed in industrialisation, nor indeed in modernisation, which of course all these this dynamism of fascism, which is keen to the ideology. So Puget loses, you know, Puget and his movement tend to lose ground. Now, Puget actually opposes the constitution of the Fifth Republic in 1958, and this really turns his party against him, because his party is so keen to go with de Gaulle as the hero of French, hero of France in its hour of need in 1958, that he actually loses. You know, he falls out effectively with most of his representatives in the National Assembly. So, you know, his movement begins to lose ground nationally, and indeed in terms of political ground in National Assembly, and in the elections of November 1962. So. Just a few years after he was first elected, really, his movement scores just 0.28% of the vote, so a huge decrease compared with the 11% it gained in 1956. Now, while Pujol is of course branded a fascist, and his anti-Semitism really does bring something of an ugly side to his movement. I think it's worth noting that he had received, not least because of his backing of, well, his failure to back the yes vote in favour of the 1958 constitution, he gained support from the Parti Communiste Français, the PCF, who were actually opposing de Gaulle. And indeed, he actually gained support from, ironically, from Pierre Mendès-France himself, because he equally opposes de Gaulle's move towards building a new towards creating a new constitution and a new republic. So Pujol does have support from other people, but his anti-Semitism, his attacks on Mendès-France, are really show something of an ugly side to his movement. And people who don't identify with this rhetoric don't then vote for him again. So he's something of a spent force, really, by 1962. Yet Pujol does something which nobody else up to this point, after the Second World War, had done, which is to raise awareness of the importance and the interests of people living in the countryside in France, these paysans. Pujol really reignites the interest in rural traditions in France. And while his concerns that the petit commerçant will eventually disappear because of you know, supermarché, the grandes surfaces, as they're known in France, while these fears are perhaps unfounded in a sense, nonetheless, the supermarket movement really did take hold in France. And somebody who I know knew Pujol, Jim Shields of Aston University, he's written an excellent synthesis of the Pujolist movement in his book, The Extreme Rights in France from Pétain to Le Pen. I remember Jim Shields certainly seems to have this idea that Pujol himself voted, actually shopped in a supermarché later on in his life. So even Pujol eventually embraced this sort of mass shopping experience, but at the time his movement failed to block the creation of supermarkets in France, but they did raise awareness of the issues around paysan and helped to sort of reignite some of the interest in rural produce and in rural methods. Now, other developments since Pujolisme, since the whole Pujolist phenomenon, include a whole series of city dwellers, if you will, people living in the city, especially Parisians, really, buying résidences secondaires in rural areas, you know, not least places like Normandy, Brittany, around the Vendée, places like the Île de Ré, which are more or less entirely occupied by Parisians with their second homes. This is a phenomenon which really does push people from the city back into the countryside. You know, granted they're not living there permanently, but they begin to take a real interest in the interests and the sort of the importance of people living in the countryside. And just like here in Britain with the Soil Association, there's a real movement towards organic products to really be interested in the patrimoine and the terroir. And people begin to buy produce like this slide here of the produits de terroir in Normandy. So you know, local wine, bread, calvados, cheese. You know, take a real interest in the rural produce, which had perhaps declined because of the influence of the supermarket. You know, while the supermarkets continued to stock rural produce when they were first founded in France, the fact is that to some extent these local regional delicacies were perhaps neglected. But in the 1980s and 1990s, they really do pick up again, and we have a real interest in these different produce. And as a kind of a latter day manifestation of Pujadisme, this man José Bové, who was effectively an anti-globalisation campaigner, he really promotes French agriculture on a national scale, on a national and international scale. And he has, on the slide there, you can see a picture of him. He has a moustache which harks back to the French rural tradition. Actually, it's a very similar moustache to the one worn by Vercingétorix, the Gaullist leader in France, who actually fought the Romans. And this is actually something which is a moustache is a symbol of this rural tradition in France, and is used quite a lot by Vichy in its own propaganda, where Vercingétorix is a figure of national importance. And Bové makes a point of promoting this rural tradition, not just in France itself, where he attacks symbols of globalisation like a McDonald's, but he also manages to get into America with his Roquefort, and goes around effectively sort of championing this French produce and this French way of life in a way which hasn't been done since Pujade. And you know, while similarities with Pujade have to end there, really, because Bové is far from a reactionary and far from a right-wing supervisor. He's somebody who is very much anti-globalisation in the same way that Pujade was, but without the sort of anti-Semitism and ugliness of the Pujadist movement. So he is sort of in a sense the inheritor of the Pujadist movement, but without the right-wing ideology that went with it. So Bové has himself promoted this idea of the French rural tradition. He's somebody who has spent some time in the USA anyway, because his father was a researcher in agricultural laboratories in America, and he like Pujade is not actually a farmer. He's just a peason in the sense that he's sort of somebody who has lived in the countryside before. But he's influenced by the revolutionary spirit of Mai 68, Les Événements de 68, that we'll see next week. And he's, you know, much more of a moderate campaigner in the sense that he's less anti-Semitic. Well, he's obviously not anti-Semitic, but he's less extreme compared to Pujade. But he's somebody who, like Pujade, really champions the cause of rural France. So while we've seen in this lecture, we've seen a considerable decline in the number of people living in the countryside, a decline in the population of paysans, the number of paysans in France. We have, you know, by the end of the 1990s and the early part of this millennium, interest in French rural traditions and interest in regionalism started to increase yet again. So while I'm not suggesting that these people have the same sort of views as someone like Maurice Barrès or Charles Maurras, nonetheless, this idea of the pays réel has started to be rekindled and started to take hold again in France, as it hasn't done before. So while we've seen the rural population decline from World War One and continue to decline under industrialisation, by the end of the last millennium and the start of this millennium, interest has really started to increase. And next week we'll really look at how urban change affected the course of French history compared with this rural change. So in the seminars this week, we'll be looking at a couple of sources which deal with rural change in France, and which produced slightly different testimonies of the extent of change in France. And we'll actually talk more about this idea of why rural France changed so much, and whether or not it's actually accurate to say that the Pisan has really declined in France. Thank you very much.